From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In 1998, writer Michael Cunningham struck pay dirt with the Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award for The Hours. The Virginia Woolf-infused novel was adapted for the big screen and again was a blockbuster hit. Nicole Kidman won the Oscar for her performance. Now, Cunningham is back with a new novel called Specimen Days. It is three novellas of the past, present, and future, stitched together by a big moral vision. A trio of characters appears, reincarnated in each of the stories, all set in New York at three different points in time, the mid-19th century, today in the aftermath of 9/11, and in the future. Presiding over each episode of this meta-story is Walt Whitman, who promised his future readers, "It avails not, neither time or place. I am with you and know how it is." Tonight on Point, Michael Cunningham, Walt Whitman, and a tale of three New Yorks. And joining me now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Michael Cunningham, author of The Hours, A Home at the End of the World, and Flesh and Blood. His new novel is Specimen Days. Michael, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So let's start with this whole notion of the three novellas, set in New York, past, present, and future, with Walt Whitman as the unifying force. Tell us a little bit about the first story, which begins with the Industrial Revolution, when it was a time when, as you say, machines literally ate people.
Yeah. It is set in New York in the 1860s and concerns a young boy who works in a foundry, an iron works, and becomes convinced that the spirits of the dead inhabit machinery and are trying to sort of suck the living into a machine world.
We have a reading that I wonder if you begin with, because it sets the stage so beautifully and I think also gives people a sense of your writing, which is quite spectacular.
Thank you. Okay, this is from the first part, in the machine. Lucas got to work. Jack would be glad of that when he came by. Lucas steadied himself before the machine. He took the first of the plates from Tom's bin. Align, clamp, pull, pull again, inspect. He inspected every plate. An hour passed, or what seemed like an hour. Another hour passed. His fingers started bleeding again. Smears of his blood were on the plates as they went under the wheel. He wiped the plates clean with his sleeve before conveying them to Dan. He began to see that the days at the works were so long, so entirely composed of the one act performed over and over and over again, that they made of themselves a world within the world, and that those who lived in that world, all the men of the works, lived primarily there and paid brief visits to the other world, where they ate and rested and made ready to return again. The men of the works had relinquished their citizenship. They had immigrated to the works as his parents had immigrated to New York from County Kerry. Their former lives were dreams they had each night, from which they awakened each morning at the works.
There is such rhythm in that passage. Mm-hmm. You know, as I'm listening to you, as I'm following along in the book, do you read aloud as you are writing these things? Because you can almost hear the thump, thump of the machines as you are reading those sentences.
You know, I do read aloud, and I advise any writer who's listening to do the same. Ideally, you read to somebody else, but if you don't happen to have someone in your life who is willing to drop everything at 3:30 on a Tuesday and come over and hear you read, you can actually do it all by yourself, like a crazy person in an empty room. You can not only tell fairly quickly the living sentences from the dead ones, you do get a sense of the rhythm and how each sentence sort of segues into the next, which is hugely important to me. Language is at least as much about music to me as it is about meaning.
Tell us a little bit about this character, Lucas.
Lucas is a malformed 12-year-old boy, an Irish immigrant, at a time when Irish immigrants were just flooding New York. People who had been starving in Ireland came to New York desperate for any kind of work at all. And the New York that received them, well, Calcutta comes to mind. It was a terrible place. People worked 6 and 7 hour days. There was no regulation at all in the workplace. It was polluted. The sky was full of coal smoke. There was no garbage pickup. If a horse dropped dead in front of your building, you just sort of walked around the horse. And Lucas finds himself living here. His older brother, Simon, has just been killed at the works, has been sucked into his machine, and by way of compensation, the works have offered his 12-year-old brother, Lucas, the job, which he is much too young for. And he shows up and faithfully feeds the iron into the machine every day and begins to be convinced that the machines have a life and a will and are animated by the spirits of the people who have been sucked into them.
And not only is he physically misshapen, he puts people off because he goes around blurting lines of poetry.
Well, yeah, he has this other work. He is convinced that he doesn't have a soul, and by way of acquiring a soul, he is memorizing Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. His teacher at school has given him this book, which is the only thing of any value anyone has ever given him. And he spends every night before he goes to sleep memorizing another passage. And what has begun to happen to him is he blurts out sections of Whitman when he becomes overexcited in an almost Tourette's-like way.
And, of course, this is not the first time that you've, in effect, channeled another writer, Virginia Woolf,
informed
The Hours. How and why does that work for you?
You know, it just seems to be something that interests me. I have to tell you that when I started this novel, I didn't expect to put Walt Whitman into it. If only because I had just written a book with a great literary hero in it, and I didn't want it to seem as if, you know, I cashed in big on Virginia Woolf. Let's see if I can make a few bucks out of Walt Whitman.
There he goes again.
There he goes again. Jane Austen was taken, but Whitman was still available. But I was aware that through this terrible, polluted, noisy, dangerous New York of the mid to late 1800s walked Walt Whitman, our great transcendental poet, our own whirling dervish, saying, "I have appetite for it all. I find it all magnificent and strange and beautiful in its way." And he felt to me like the imperishable part of humanity that can not only survive the worst that could happen, but actually find some joy in it. And so I put him in.
Well, and indeed, he does give Lucas such grace. I'm wondering, as you went back to read Walt Whitman, as I'm sure you had to, mm-hmm. Very carefully over a period of time to be able to do this, as you read him, were you thinking about which words might fit into these stories, or did the stories come first?
The stories and the Whitman sort of worked simultaneously. One of the miraculous things about working with Leaves of Grass is I would get to a point in the story at which Lucas or another character in one of the other stories was going to sort of inadvertently speak a line or two of Whitman's, and I could open Leaves of Grass almost at random and find the perfect line. I was going to say it was magical. I don't think it was magic. I think a part of a measure of Whitman's greatness is the fact that every line of that vast poem is full of meaning and full of resonance, and it never took me more than a few minutes to find just the right line for the moment in the story.
I want to also ask about the pressure that you may have felt as you sat down to write this one. I mean, The Hours was such a huge success. Nicole Kidman and Meryl Streep and Ed Harris being in the film and the great acclaim and the Academy Award and all of that. I mean, are you able to take that and push it aside when you sit down to tell a new story, or is that hovering somewhere over your shoulder of, "Ooh, I hope this one will be as good or perhaps even better"?
You know, I do my best to impersonate someone who's undaunted by the expectations, which is about the best I can do. after the Pulitzer was announced, my first thought was, you know, Yahoo, and then my very quickly arriving second thought was, right, Michael Cunningham, the pre has been years. Only one direction to go, and it's probably not up, is it? But then after some time, I realized that part of what had been demonstrated by the success of the Hours, by its broad readership, was that American readers are not nearly as foolish as they're made out to be. And the only sensible thing, the only right thing to do with that particular gift I've been given was to forge on ahead and push the envelope and try to do something that I wasn't sure if I could do, try to write a bigger book than I might be capable of writing.
It must have felt like such a relief when you were done.
Oh, I can't tell you what a relief it felt like. And I hope never to struggle quite so hard with another book again. This was an extremely difficult one to write.
Well, we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to get to hear some more from your new book. We're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Cunningham about his new novel, Specimen Days. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with author Michael Cunningham, who won the Pulitzer for his book, The Hours, and his new novel is Specimen Days. And Michael, I want to ask you a little bit about Catherine, who's one of the characters who appears in the first story and then in a different guise in the second story.
Right.
Give us a sense of who she was, and particularly who she was to Lucas.
In the first story, she is the fiancée, the ex-fiancée of Lucas's older brother, who has been killed before the story begins, and Lucas is deeply and desperately in love with her, though she is 25 and he is 12, and he really has no full appreciation of how slim his chances are, and he becomes convinced that the machines, the living machinery, especially desires Catherine, and because he does, and he, so naturally the machines would too, and he becomes obsessed with trying to protect her from. She works in a sewing company, rather like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, and he becomes obsessed with the idea of trying to save her from the machines there.
And then in the second novella, she morphs into a character called Cat Martin. Tell us about Cat Martin and the terrorist children.
Well, not only do the same three characters figure in each of the three stories, a different character is the protagonist in each story. So Lucas was the sort of primary character in the first story, and now here is Catherine, reincarnated as Cat Martin, an African-American forensic psychologist whose job it is to man the phones and deal with any kook or crackpot who calls in with a threat and try to determine which of them are genuinely dangerous and which of them are simply sort of safely ignorable.
And that has special resonance for her when she gets a call from a very young man, because she has also lost a son.
She has lost a son, and she gets a call from a boy who sounds like he's about 13 or 14, saying that he is going to blow somebody up. And she decides this isn't serious. Kids call up all the time with threats like this, and she sort of puts it down. She puts it down the path that leads to no further investigation, and soon after, a boy of about 13 with a bomb strapped to his chest walks up to what, as far as anyone can tell, is a random stranger on the street and blows them both up.
I wonder if you'd do another reading for us. This from the Children's Crusade, the title of the second novella. And this is about a New York post 9/11, a city that certainly you're familiar with, post 9/11.
Yeah. City in which I live. Cat started down Broadway. If you didn't know what had happened, you could easily believe it was just another night in the city. The sidewalks were a little less crowded. People were moving with more than the usual degrees of slink or alacrity. But if you were fresh from Mongolia or Uganda, you wouldn't have any but the usual touristic impressions. The city was only being rocked in its less visible parts, along its filaments, in its dreams of itself. People were scared, and yes, it was impossible to know yet just how much money was bleeding out, how many reservations were being canceled, how many corporations were considering relocating. But Broadway was still full of cabs and trucks. Stores were still open. Unfortunates still worked the passersby for change. The machinery of the city, the immense discordant poetry of the city, thank you, Mr. Whitman, racketed on. You had to bring a building down to make things look different. Tonight, there were no candlelight vigils, no mounds of flowers, no women wailing. It all went on.
Michael Cunningham, reading from his new novel, Specimen Days. Walt Whitman also featured New York as a character. I'm wondering, is that one of the reasons why you set your stories there? That's also where you live, of course. Is that what made it feel right?
You know, it is the city I know best. It was Whitman's city, one of his cities. And, you know, in that great Ken Burns documentary from a few years ago about New York from its founding to the present day, a historian, I think it might have been Mike Wallace, said that as far as the people who study the history of New York can tell, roughly every 40 years, the New York in which you find yourself standing bears no resemblance whatsoever to the New York of 40 years ago and will bear similarly no resemblance to the New York 40 years to come. So the idea of these three stories set over a long period of time, beginning with the Industrial Revolution and ending with cloning and interstellar travel, seemed like it ought to take place in a city as volatile and changeable as New York.
And also in this part of the book, I got the sense that in a post 9/11 world, people were horrified by these things happening, but not that surprised. The children blowing strangers up.
Yeah. It is, of course, as you say, horrifying, and yet as it begins happening, because there's one incident and then another, there is a certain sense of terrible recognition as the people of New York and I think the people of the entire country begin to understand what people in many other countries have known for a long, long time, that you're never really safe. You just don't know when someone randomly, as an act of terrorism, will decide that today is your day.
And so it becomes, well, there was another one. You know, the newspapers play it differently.
Yeah.
Some are alarmed and some are just, well, another terrorist bombing, as if.
Yeah.
Let me change the subject a little bit back to Walt Whitman, because he was such a fascinating man,
as well as an
amazing writer, obviously.
If
you were alive today, what do you think he'd be doing? Rock star? PR man? talk show radio, perhaps?
He might be doing any of those things. He might, in fact, be doing exactly what he did 150 years ago. He might be writing the ongoing, endless, unendable epic poem of the world in which he lived. There are still, of course, poets, and I suspect Walt Whitman might have insisted on being one. Or, of course, he might have been the greatest rock star in the world has ever seen.
What do you think he would make of present-day New York?
You know, I think because he was no fool, there was nothing naive or sentimental about him, I think much of present-day New York and present-day America would be appalling to him, but I also think he would find it fantastic and fascinating and strangely beautiful, even in its darkest, dankest recesses. That was one of his great contributions, his ability to unfoolishly love the world and everything that can happen.
Well, and certainly the city still pulses with the kind of energy and exuberance that he wrote about.
Oh, it sure does. It sure does. That's part of why I love it so much.
Your first story was described by one reviewer as Dickens-like, and the second as an episode of CSI. I sort of chuckled at that and wondered what you think about that. Do you smile at other people's attempts to kind of get their arms around your stories and explain them?
You know, I do smile when these things are recounted to me. I don't read reviews, but people sort of fill me in on what's being said out there. Well, naturally, like as anyone would be, I'm a little bit happier with a comparison to Dickens than I am with a comparison to CSI.
Well, I think he was referring specifically to the sort of small talk that makes these characters come alive. So it was not a diss.
Yeah. Gotcha. And I actually love CSI. I wanted the middle section to have a very different kind of rhythm, a very different kind of language, to feel very modern and a little jazzy, a little rock and rolly. Maybe a little like television or a movie that really rocks along.
You really don't read reviews at all?
I really don't. I really and truly don't. After The Hours, I read reviews when The Hours came out, and it's fine. When other people would tell me they never read reviews, I thought, oh, right.
How could you resist?
But as you publish a book and then another book and then another, you begin to realize that, it's great to get good reviews. Who doesn't love that? But they're not especially instructive. They're just nice pats on the back. And the bad reviews, and I think if you're doing your work as a novelist, there will inevitably be bad reviews. Why would you want to write a novel that isn't going to tick some people off? But it's hard not to take those in. It's hard not to have those phrases and those critical voices in your head saying essentially, oh, buddy, you can't do it. So I just try to keep myself distance. And again, there's no way to insulate yourself. I have a pretty clear sense of who liked the book, who hated the book, but I don't know the particulars.
As you were writing this one, did you see it as a movie, having gone through that experience?
No. I mean, obviously, my choice of material is very much movie esque, if such a word exists. But after The Hours was made into that beautiful and surprisingly successful movie, one of the things I thought to myself is you must not, under any circumstances, fall into the habit of writing novels as sort of intermediate steps toward the movies. This book is so sort of sprawling and odd and would cost so much money to make, and wouldn't by any means be a surefire hit, that I thought, fine, this one is safe from the movies.
Well, speaking of the voices in your head, where did you start writing this one? Which part of the story came first?
I started with the first story. I just wrote them sequentially because I knew the first story needed to demonstrate not only its characters and its plot, but it's sort of recurring images so that they could carry on into the next story. So like each story determined the next one.
Well, starting with the first one, did you spend some time walking around? I don't know how many of those old factory buildings still remain, but I'm sure there are some in the city. That part of your steeping yourself in that time and place and being
absolutely
able to imagine Lucas's world?
Yeah, you have to. I walked all over every route that I describe in the story. There are massive housing projects along the East River where a lot of these foundries and factories were. So they're no longer there. But much of the East Village, the Five Points, which were just deplorable, unbelievable slums, are still there, and those buildings are still standing. They just have wine bars and pet boutiques in them now.
Hmm. When you moved on to the other parts of the story, did you know that there would always be three, and the challenge was to connect them? I mean, how did that process work? When did you know that you were done with the first part of the story and that there were two more that needed to be told?
You know, I kept vacillating about that. I knew I wanted to do more than one. And at first I thought, maybe two's enough, because I wanted to work connections and see if I could make the various genres sort of work in some kind of sort of syncopation with each other. But then two has a kind of deadly symmetry. And then I wrote a third and thought of a fourth and thought, no, three's the charm. Just stop here.
Should I ask what the fourth would have been?
it would have been a romance. It would have been a bodice ripper.
Okay.
I actually started it and didn't get very far.
And then said, no, I'm done. The three
now
tells
I'm
the story I want to tell.
Yeah. I also realized that I love ghost stories and thrillers and science fiction stories. I never meant this to be any kind of ironic, pomo, condescending commentary on lesser forms. I love these forms. And I don't really love bodice rippers. I read a bunch of them and didn't find them especially compelling.
There are so many themes here that you explore. One of them, women not being what they seem. One, the point of life, the nature of death, Whitman's insistence that we are all part of the grass and the trees. That's pretty heavy-duty stuff to be grappling with, and I wonder if it left you with a different sense of life and death, or was it your sensibility that was the struggle to get onto the page?
Oh, I think one of the reasons you write novels is to try to develop in yourself a sort of bigger, more complicated sense of life and death, if for no other reason than bringing that bigger, more complicated sense of life and death to the next novel you write. But it's very much a sort of ongoing tutorial, if you will, for lack of a better term. I mean, I think any novelist I respect is spending his or her life learning how to write a novel, and I still trying to learn how to write a novel.
And as you were writing this one and reading it to friends and people whose opinions you respect, how much does that guide the process? If someone says, oh, I really like this, but I really hated that, you know, can you listen to that and you know, does it become part of the process, or are you able to say, well, I'm sorry if you didn't like that part, but I feel strongly about it and I'm going to leave it in?
Well, both. I mean, why would you show something to somebody if you weren't going to listen to what they had to say? And I have a sort of SWAT team of readers at my disposal who are fantastically insightful, and I actually couldn't write these books without them. I count on them for their ability to read through a draft and say, this works, not that. At the same time, you must never listen to anybody absolutely. Finally, you are the judge, and if something feels right, deeply right to you, you leave it, even if it feels wrong to everybody else.
Was there anything like that in this process for you?
Oh, let me think a minute. Yeah, without giving too much away, there is a bowl that's
yes,
sort of handed down from story to story, and one of my very favorite readers, the bowl has some mysterious writing on it in an unknown language, and one of my very favorite readers was determined that I had to tell in the end what the bowl actually said, and I was determined that I was not going to do that.
Well, I have to confess, I was waiting to read that too. So.
Yeah, after the broadcast, I'll tell you privately what it says.
Okay. Otherwise, we'll just have to wait.
Yeah.
We are channeling Walt Whitman with Michael Cunningham this hour, author of the new novel Specimen Days. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Cunningham about his new novel, Specimen Days. And Michael, now we're getting to the part of the third story, which was absolutely fascinating. Tell us a little bit about it, and then I'd love for you to do a reading for us.
Well, the third story is science fiction, which I'm discovering is the genre that is most horrifying to most readers. A lot of serious readers who are more than happy to read a ghost story or a thriller recoil at the idea of science fiction, but I do not. Here, Simon is the hero. He was already deceased in the first story, and is the sort of all too slick, all too prosperous boyfriend of Kat, the forensic psychologist, in the second story, and now he is a cyborg, a sort of half-man, half-machine, almost as if he has gone into the machine at the beginning of the book and come out transmogrified at the end. He lives in a New York of the future, which has been made into a theme park. You can go and visit the perfectly reconstructed slums that Lucas and Catherine lived in the first part, and you know see actors working in foundries, and go to Midtown in the 20s and watch Daisy and Gatsby drive by, or if you are of a particular turn of mind, a turn of taste, you can pay to have yourself mugged in Central Park. And Simon, who is on the lam, the kind of he's a cyborg, and they're being rounded up. Simon works as a mugger for hire. It's one of the only jobs he can get. And there in the park, he meets an alien woman named Katarine. We have made our first contact in this future with an inhabited planet, and it turns out all of our fantasies about superior technology and incredibly sophisticated spiritual systems were fantasies. The people of Nadia are actually worse off than anybody on Earth, and when the Earth ships arrive, they can't wait to get off their planet and come to the Earth, where they get the lowest possible jobs and are despised by everyone. So he's a cyborg. She's a 4.5 foot tall lizard woman from another planet. She was, by Earth standards, a 4.5 foot tall lizard with prominent nostrils and eyes slightly smaller than golf balls. But Simon believed she might have been glorious on her own planet. She might have been better than useful there. He saw her every evening, walking the children through the park. She always came at the same time, just after his shift started. She was modest but certain in her movements. Her skin was emerald. It had a clean, gem-like shine, rare among the Nadians. Most were mossier-looking. Their skins were mottled, prone to splotches of ochre and dark brown. This was why people insisted that they were oily and that they smelled. They were not oily. They did not smell. They did not smell bad. All creatures smelled. The Nadian smell was sweet and cleanly fermented. Most people never got close enough to know that.
Certainly an interesting way to approach some themes about immigration and about prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
A lot going on with this character, and she was indeed glorious on her own planet.
Yes, she was. She's my first non-human character. It's my first interspecies love story.
Well, and without giving away the ending, which I certainly don't want to do, but, you know, the book does end on a hopeful note, and I think with a renewed appreciation of what it means to be human. You know,
Absolutely.
You are rooting for Simon to kind of put some things together.
Yeah. I don't ever expect to write a book that doesn't end on a hopeful note. I mean, you never know, but I am deeply interested in the fact that life goes on and we seem to survive, and our capacity for joy in being alive seems to survive. But I'm only interested in the joy and the hope and the optimism that can survive the worst that can possibly happen to people. Anything else feels sort of cheap.
Hmm. Was this the most difficult of the three stories to imagine? Because while many people, as you noted, turn up their nose at the notion of sci-fi, there is a school of thought that says that's actually the most difficult writing of all.
Yeah. I think it is. It was enormously difficult to write. And I was very much aware that I was sort of writing in the shadow of certain science fiction writers who I think are among the most gifted and serious writers at work today, people like Ursula Le Guin and Samuel Delaney, Octavia Butler. These are not names that are necessarily familiar to a lot of people, but they should be.
I would imagine you had to read a lot of it to get absorbed in the style, no?
I did. I read a great deal of it, and that was a huge pleasure because it's something of a revelation, because really, really, some of those books are just remarkable, and I think too few people are reading them because they're over there in that special section.
That's right, where you don't want to go.
Where you don't dare go.
Not if you're a serious reader.
Right.
Well, I have to say, I found myself wanting to reread Whitman by the time I finished your book.
Right.
Are you finding other people have that reaction as well? Are we going to be swamped with a whole new appreciation of Whitman from your readers?
Well, nothing would make me happier. And one of the great satisfactions of the success of The Hours was watching Mrs. Dalloway climb the bestseller charts. I don't know if this book will have a similar effect on people's interest in Walt Whitman, but of course I'd be thrilled if it did.
Well, I have to ask whether you get to relax for a while now, or is there something else percolating in your brain? My guess is yes. Can you tell us what it is?
Yeah. I have what I always have, which is a very sort of vague, embryonic idea for another book, as in, I think I'd like to do something about Virginia Woolf, or I think I'd like to do something with genre, but I can never go straight to work on a new book. You know, Thackeray wrote for 5 hours every day, and if he finished a novel in the first 3 hours, he started a new one for the remaining 2 hours. I hate Thackeray. I am not like that. No, I don't hate Thackeray, but I mean, I'm so not capable of doing something like that. It takes me months to sort of regenerate my batteries, and I usually try to find something else to do in between novels, or I stumble into something else to do. I'm actually writing a screenplay based on a novel I didn't write, and I love doing that.
Well, tell me more about that. Why?
Sure. I got a call from Universal asking if I would be interested in adapting a novel called Good Grief by a writer named Lolly Winston for Julia Roberts. And at first I thought, well, thank you for asking, but that's not really the kind of thing I do. It's a lovely, very moving book about a young woman whose husband dies, and she bottoms out and then sort of finds her life again. And I talked to Julia at Universal's request, and it turned out that we felt very simpatico about how this story might be made into a movie that would be good, that would be resonant and emotional and funny. I love the movies, and not just, you know, Bergman. I love all kinds of movies, and the idea of writing a really good, I mean, you can only hope, but a really good sort of tragic romantic comedy. I love. Why not?
And so that's underway now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm about two-thirds of the way through it.
Ah, well, we'll look forward to that. We'll trust that you won't be completely seduced by Hollywood.
No, no. Well, that's what they all say, right?
Oh, no. Not me.
Oh, no, not me. Yeah, check with me in a couple of years.
Well, Michael Cunningham, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you with us.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
Author Michael Cunningham's new novel is Specimen Days. You may find yourself wanting to read it twice. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. At the White House today, President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari stood side by side, reaffirming their commitment to defeat the terrorists in Iraq. The meeting coincided with news of yet another suicide bombing in Fallujah that killed at least two Marines and left another 13 wounded. But in spite of the continued violence and falling support from Americans of the president's handling of the situation in Iraq, the prime minister gave this reassurance.
I see from up close what's happening in Iraq, and I know we are making steady and substantial progresses.
President Bush shared his optimism on the progress being made.
These are monumental tasks, yet at every step of the way so far, the Iraqi people have met their strategic objectives, and the terrorists have failed to stop them. I commend the Prime Minister and his fellow Iraqis for their hard work and courage.
Well, joining me now from Washington is David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. David, welcome.
Thank you, Gail. Good to be back.
So the president and the prime minister, it sounds, are seeing the glasses half full, but more Americans seem to be seeing it as more than half empty, judging by the latest polls. What's the White House doing to try to persuade them otherwise?
Well, they were on this campaign, which has really been running all week, as the president has spoken much more about Iraq than he has at any time in the past number of months, and will continue through Tuesday when the president's going to Fort Bragg and is giving a primetime speech on Tuesday night about Iraq. What I found the most interesting in listening to the president this week and listening to Prime Minister Jafari is that while they are articulating the strategy more forcefully, they are basically articulating the same strategy that we've heard for the past year. And the difficulty the president's running into, of course, is that not only those declining poll numbers, but an apparent disagreement between some members of his own administration and the military about whether or not the insurgency is in fact weakening. In other words, whether the strategy is working.
Well, exactly. We heard earlier this week from General John Abizade, who said that more foreign fighters are coming into Iraq, that the insurgency's overall strength is about the same as it was 6 months ago. But a few days before that, the vice president said that the insurgency was in its last throes. I mean, how do you account for that disconnect?
You know, I can't account for that disconnect, but what is perhaps more interesting is they're having a hard time accounting for the disconnect. In testimony yesterday, you saw several moments where General Abizade was basically asked, would you sign on with the vice president's language, and he would not, and neither would Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld. The president has been asked about this twice now. He was asked about it once about a week and a half ago when we had the South Korean president here. He was asked about it again today. And he deals with the issue by not answering the question about our current assessment, but instead discussing his optimism for the future.
Well, and also as to the matter of timetables, because there is a mounting call in Congress for withdrawal of American troops at some point. Here's what the president said at the press conference this morning.
There are not going to be any timetables. I mean, I've told this to the prime minister. We are there to complete a mission, and it's an important mission.
Well, which again, David, raises the question of, you know, how much longer can he keep saying that? And Can he quiet the people in Congress who are saying, well, no, we'd kind of like to have a date there?
Well, they've got two different issues underway here. Number one, Prime Minister Jafari was sort of on the same page. I was at a speech he gave here after he arrived last night. And in that speech, he also said he didn't want timetables. You can make that argument, I think, more convincingly as a political matter if there's evidence that, in fact, your approach is quelling the insurgency. But in the absence of that evidence, it becomes more difficult because it raises the question of how long you're willing to put up with stalemate. Now, he argues that that's not going to be the case, that the Iraqi troops will get trained up and that over time we'll be able to come out, and that if you set timetables, the insurgents just sit back and wait for you to withdraw and then do their attacks. Now, the counterargument to that is the insurgents may be doing that anyway, whether or not you announce the timetable.
Hmm. Well, and to the other point of you can't just stand there and say that progress is being made. Is there evidence to be had on that point?
There is certainly some evidence to be had on that. The president marshaled some of it today. He said every political timetable that has been set, drafting the TAL, the temporary law, holding the elections in January, organizing to work on the Constitution, that the Iraqis have met every one of those, sometimes over, you know, significant violence going on in the streets. And he says that that's been impressive. And in fact, you know, the day of the vote in January, it was impressive. The difficulty they're running into is that the second part of the strategy that they were describing was that once these institutions began to come together, they thought that that would weaken the insurgency because they say the insurgents have no plan and the parliamentarians do. Unfortunately, that has not yet come to pass. It may eventually, but it hasn't yet, and we're 2 years and 3 months from the invasion. And that's the difficulty. Nobody in the White House expected to be in this position 2 years and 3 months after the invasion.
Well, and the Prime Minister is predicting that the Constitution will be concluded by the end of August. How critical is that, and is that timeline realistic? We heard also from the International Crisis Group this week saying that deadline should be extended for 6 more months to allow more public education and broad consultation about its contents.
There is room within the existing law and regulations on this to allow some delay if they want. The downside of allowing delay is that what they're trying to prove to Iraqis is they are really taking over their own country, and that the sooner that they take responsibility for that, the more they'll have a stake in fighting off the insurgency. You know, sort of the difference between renting a country and buying one, you know. Once you've bought one, then you have a real interest in defending it. So there is some pressure to get that going and to make the Iraqis themselves more fully invested in defending the country. But it's also clear that they're going to require significant international help, and that means American help, for some good time to come.
David Sanger, we'll be keeping an eye on it, as you will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Sanger is White House correspondent for The New York Times. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.